This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to this Joy 94.9 podcast.
We want to hear from you.
It's time for our listener survey. So head to the Joy website and let us know what you love about the station and your presenters.
Maybe you'd like to share your thoughts on Joy's program production team, the volunteers behind Joy Podcasts.
The results of this survey will assist us in continuing to be the best possible station we can be.
Head to joy.org.au and have your say. Joy 94.9, your voice, your radio station.
Well, bringing you all the up-to-date information on sexual health and well-being. Brought to you by the Victorian AIDS Council, Gay Men's Health Centre, on Joy 94.9.
Hello and welcome to Well on Joy 94.9, presented to you every week by the Victorian AIDS Council as we talk about health and well-being in our gender, sex and sexually diverse community. I'm Adam and I'm joined this week by my co-host, John. Excited for tonight's show?
Extremely excited. Very happy to be here.
Very, very excited, are you?
Yeah, something along those lines.
So, what is on the show tonight?
Well, we've had a lot going on in our community the last few months, or years, if you want to see. We've seen a very odd culture of anger and fear and conflict and tension rising up. And with things like the plebiscite on the horizon and just some unpleasantness, we want to see what's happening in the community as far as mental health and well-being and how people are coping. So, we're going to be talking about the lovely topic of prejudice-motivated crime with the lovely Lee Carney from the Human Rights Law Center. And hopefully we can get some interesting coping strategies out of it and learn something and be better moving forward.
I like it. I think we're on the right track.
All right.
Well, not necessarily on that right track, but having a conversation about something that's
exactly
topical, that everybody's talking about, it's in the mainstream, so let's bring it to the forefront of our community and have a bit of a chat about what we can do. But if people who are listening at home want to get involved, how can they?
We've got several ways, but the best way is to email us here in the studio at onair@joy.org.au, or you can SMS us directly at 0427-JOY949, both of which will get to us immediately.
Well, on Joy 94.9.
This is Well on Joy 94.9. We are joined in the studio today by a wonderful guest, Lee Carney. She is a lawyer at the Human Rights Law Center specializing in LGBTI issues, and she's here to talk to us tonight about prejudice-motivated crime, resilience, and how we cope with our mental health in light of all that fun, exciting kindness that's being hurled in our direction from every possible place. Welcome, Lee.
Thank you for having me on tonight.
So I guess for people out there who don't know what the Human Rights Law Centre is, what is it and what do you actually do there?
So we're an Australia-wide not-for-profit organisation. Our work is in promoting and protecting human rights, but specifically what our unit looks at is protecting and promoting human rights for LGBTI people in Australia and also internationally. So what we try to do is we try to achieve lasting systemic change through a combination of advocacy and strategic litigation and research, education and capacity building for LGBTI community members to leverage long-term impacts.
So just a couple of things that rolls off the tongue really easily.
How do you select the issues that you decide to take up? How do you prioritize them and what do they look like?
Yeah, unfortunately, we have to be very strategic about what we can take on. I wish we could say that we were lawyers and there was free legal representation for every LGBTI person in Australia, but unfortunately that's not the case. And there's a tendency to choose issues based on what projects you can get funded. For example, you know, there's a lot of funding around family violence at the moment because it's seen as kind of a topical issue. Or to focus on what's receiving a lot of media attention, so things like the marriage equality plebiscite at the moment. And if that's all you do, then crucial issues like prejudice-motivated crime get missed. So I suppose what we focus on are areas where we can add legal expertise to what LGBTI community organisations are doing. So we're really focusing on ending discrimination entrenched within our legal system in Australia, improved recognition of LGBTI people, redress for past wrongs. So this, you know, has to do with the apology and expungement of historical criminal convictions, the right to bodily integrity, and the fundamental to that is protecting LGBTI people from harm using the legal system.
God, it's full on.
Good luck. Well, obviously, it's got to be a hard thing to sort of, I guess, to take away the nuts and the bolts of it, to really get down to the nitty-gritty, and you go, well, how do I make that systemic change, and how do I make it sustainable, and how do you tackle just one specific case at a time whilst trying to get to everywhere? But, I mean, we've been talking about prejudice-motivated crime. Mm. So exactly what does that phrase mean? Because I've watched a lot of Law and Order and I haven't heard that.
Yeah, so you've probably heard it as hate crime.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah.
Apprehensible terms here.
So in the US, they talk about hate crime. Yeah. In Australia, we use the term prejudice-motivated crime as a slightly more nuanced term.
Yeah.
So when we use the language of hate crime, sometimes it's very easy for people who don't support hate crime legislation to say, well, how can you tell that's based on hate? Hate is a feeling. And was it really as strong as hate? What we're looking at when we talk about prejudice-motivated crime is existing crimes which are motivated by prejudice towards a particular group of people or based on a particular characteristic. So, for example, where a victim of a crime has been intentionally selected by a perpetrator because of their sexual orientation, or because of their gender identity, because of their intersex status, and importantly, it's their perceived or actual attribute. So it could be that they look at someone and they think that person looks like they are gay, or that person looks like they are trans, and they commit the crime at least partially or wholly because of that prejudice.
And so does motivation have to be explicitly stated? Because as you said, it's the intention behind it. So how do you differentiate between what is overt and what is not overt, and how do you determine that someone's actual motivations for it to be determined a prejudice crime?
Yeah, and this is where it gets incredibly difficult. We have a provision of the Sentencing Act here in Victoria that requires magistrates and judges to consider the motivation of a person in committing a crime. And if they believe that it is motivated by prejudice towards a particular group of people because of one of these attributes that we spoke about, then it's an aggravating feature. So in theory, it means that they will receive a harsher penalty because prejudice-motivated crime diminishes us as a society as a whole. It has a significantly more serious impact on the individual, on the target group, on other vulnerable groups, and, you know, on society in general. But in practice, it's very difficult to be able to tell this because you're not looking at, you know, what physically happened, and you don't have to prove beyond reasonable doubt, which is a high standard of proof, what happened. You have to show what's in the head of another person. So when it's been explicitly stated, and there have been cases in Victoria where it has been explicitly stated, where there have been witnesses or where the victim has said, well, this person said this thing to me before I was assaulted, and that had, you know, racial... you know, it was racially abusive or was abusive towards people because of their sexual orientation, for example. So that's easier to prove what was going on in the head of the perpetrator. But what's more difficult is to, you know, how you could prove what was really going on in their head. And a lot of the cases that have looked at this issue have said, well, you know, we can't really prove that it was motivated by prejudice. It could have been motivated by, you know, first and foremost, an opportunistic attempt to rob someone or to assault someone, and the fact that they happen to be from this particular marginalized group in society, it could have been a coincidence. How do you prove that? Any defense lawyer worth their salt would advise the perpetrator to stay silent and not to say anything about that. So it is incredibly difficult to prove, which is why that this law, which has been around since 2010, has actually very rarely been used in sentencing.
Fantastic.
Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9. We're still in the studio with Lee Carney from the Human Rights Law Center, talking about prejudice-motivated crimes, or hate crimes, as you sometimes heard them called. And it's quite a clinical big term, and it's a lot to unpack. But what's interesting about it is, what do these things look like? What do these crimes or these incidents look like?
So they range in severity, and they're the kinds that we hear about in the newspapers, which are on the more severe end of the scale. So these are the ones that you've probably heard of. These are serious physical assaults, these are sexual assaults, and in some cases murder. And then they range from those very severe ones, which we probably hear a lot about, but are in the scheme of things more rare in terms of their occurrence, to the kinds of crimes which we think of, I think, in the community is relatively minor, but which are so prevalent in terms of how we experience these kinds of incidents. And that includes things like being a victim of threatening, abusive or insulting words or language in public. There have been, and you know, there continue to be reports of people being verbally harassed on the street. When we look at statistics about these kinds of issues in, you know, the private lives too, which we've all heard of a lot, and inside private lives too, we look at the types of verbal harassment that have been experienced, and they're just so high in terms of trans and gender diverse people in particular in the last 12 months. It was around 50% for trans people just experiencing this kind of verbal abuse and verbal harassment.
And is verbal harassment considered a crime? I mean, is it illegal to yell obscenities? I mean, everyone at the football should be arrested, basically. at one point or another, or the abhorrent people that scream out stuff that really shouldn't be said. But that's the thing. You kind of go, you know, you hear terms get bandied around all the time or yelled out from a car and whatnot, but you go, well, that's just not a crime. That's just an ignorant idiot from the suburbs who doesn't know any better isn't familiar. But that's a crime?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think most people don't know that it is a crime and that there are things that the police can do about this kind of, you know, this kind of abuse that the LGBTIQ community receives on a daily basis. So if I get technical, it's Section 17 of the Summary Offences Act, but essentially it prohibits people from using threatened, abusive or insulting words. So there have been cases where Victoria Police has, for example, received a report from a person who's been walking down the street and someone's driven by in a car and yelled something threatening and abusive, and that's been reported to the police, and the police have been able to issue a fine for that person or charge them, which leads to them being prosecuted in court. In addition to that, so this is really, you know, using abusive language, there's also specific provisions when it comes to bullying as well. So this can be motivated by prejudice as well. Ongoing abuses, it falls under the definition of stalking. As well, yeah. So when we talk about Brodie's Law, which was, you know, employment-based bullying.
I remember that.
So essentially what that led to was this led to stronger criminal protections against this kind of abuse. But that includes the kind of ongoing bullying and harassment that LGBTIQ young people receive in schools, and we know continue to receive in schools today. And that kind of behaviour, that's a criminal offence, but there's also other protections for that as well. So, for example, if there's ongoing stalking or bullying or continued harassment, you try to stop the person from following you and yelling things, or they're a neighbour in your street and they continue to harass you and you can't get them to stop, it's not... the police aren't able to press charges for whatever reasons. There's a number of reasons why that's the case. Then you can also think about intervention orders to protect someone from stalking you or from bullying you.
Yeah. And we've heard stories about this. I know there's an organization called the Anti-Violence Project that kind of helps people liaise and take complaints as far as those things go, because a lot of people do have quite a bit of hesitation about approaching the police for various reasons, historic injustices and whatnot. But hearing people who have had to move houses because such incidents have been carrying on and carrying on, and yet they don't feel safe reporting relatively minor incidences in some cases, but in others quite severe. And basically they're having their entire lives upended because somebody chose to target them for their sexual orientation or some characteristic like that. And it's absolutely heartbreaking.
Absolutely. And when we're talking about, you know, what the police can do in these kinds of situations, the law is a very blunt instrument when it comes to dealing with these kinds of issues. For example, the law can deal with individual cases quite well when each individual case is severe enough to merit a criminal charge. But where what is affecting the mental health of an individual is the cumulative impact of ongoing harassment, where each individual incident that doesn't involve enough evidence or doesn't have enough evidence behind it to be able to charge or isn't seen as serious enough for the police to prosecute, then the criminal justice system is not the appropriate method for dealing with these kinds of behaviours.
It brings up this vivid image that keeps coming to me, but it seems more and more relevant the more we talk about issues like this. And I think it was Margaret Cho who said it. She's like, living as a minority is like living with 1,000 paper cuts. You don't necessarily have these big blunt bruises, but you just have these little things that drain you. And how do we go about that? How do we confront that? And how do we address it to make it improve?
Well, I think what we will do is we will address that after the next song.
Joy 94.9.
This is Well on Joy 94.9. So before we'd gone to that song, we were actually talking about something called Private Lives 2. And you sort of mentioned that there was a lot of stats coming out of that. So, I mean, about how often these crimes occur. So what is Private Lives 2 and how accurately does it reflect what's happening in the community? Because even though sometimes we're an over-surveyed population, in certain elements we're kind of very well underrepresented. So, I mean, what is Private Lives 2 for anyone who hasn't heard of it before?
Absolutely. So it's a 2012 survey. It's the second national survey of its kind, looking primarily at the health and well-being of GLBT Australians, conducted by La Trobe University and GLHV. In terms of what it says about prejudice-motivated crime, though, it looks at the different types of violence that the LGBT community experiences. Mm. And the reason why this report is so important is because we just don't know how many incidents there are out there. Yeah. There is underreporting to community organisations. A lot of the time people think that the incidents aren't serious enough, that they don't merit reporting it to the community or to Victoria Police. A lot of the time with these kinds of incidents as well, people think, well, there's nothing I can do about it. So, you know, what's the point of going and talking to someone about it? So we really don't know. So Private Lives 2 is really the most recent survey that we've got that looks at these types of violence that the community experiences. In terms of violence, verbal abuse, non-physical verbal abuse was the most prevalent at about 25.5%. And then you look at, you know, harassment, more kind of ongoing harassment and verbal abuse, and that was at 15.5%. I should say that was just in the 12 months preceding when the survey was conducted. That wasn't over, you know, an entire person's lifespan. It's just over the last 12 months, people have experienced this. Threats of physical violence, about 8.7% of people, and written abuse was about 6.6%. It'd be interesting if that was conducted now, a few years later, to see, you know, now that people are using social media a bit more and that young people are growing up using that kind of online form, whether those stats have changed at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've only been with HRLC just a short time, but have you seen any difference in the information that you receive or what people are asking you about for assistance with in that time?
So I have actually started at the Human Rights Law Centre relatively recently. I'm trying to think about whether there's been any increase. I know from discussions with LGBTI specific community organisations that there's been an increase in the number of calls that they've been receiving this year. Some somewhat connected to the public attacks on safe schools and debates and the kind of fear that this produces in the LGBTI community about safety and about fears of being outed, fears of what's going to happen to families, fears of the bullying that they're going to be subjected to. And so we know that this is having a significant impact. I should say that before I started at the Human Rights Law Centre, I was actually a youth lawyer. So I worked at a not-for-profit organisation called Youth Law, and I was in the court almost every day. And a significant proportion of our clients were LGBTI young people. I specialised in youth homelessness and drug outreach. And so, unfortunately, a large number of the LGBTIQ young people that I was assisting who had legal issues had been forced from the family home because of family violence, had experienced all kinds of bullying and abuse, living on the street, in refuges, while they were experiencing homelessness. And this led to, you know, this particular subset of our community having such poor mental health outcomes compared to other young people their age, and led to, you know, more risk-taking behaviours and more concerns around, you know, their drug use and alcohol use. So that was my previous experience, I should say, before starting at the Human Rights Law Centre.
So an easy one. By no stretch. But I mean, I guess you talked about sort of the mental health outcomes of experiencing this abuse or these incidents or these crimes. But what are the usual outcomes, I guess, from a legal sense, if a crime is deemed prejudiced? I mean, you did say that it actually has an impact on sentencing, but does it actually change what happens in a legal sense for the person who's experienced the crime if it's actually deemed prejudiced?
No, so it doesn't have an impact on for the victim except for, you know, if it's in terms of the sentence that has been passed down, there could be comments recognising that someone has been targeted because it was prejudice motivated. But otherwise, the other avenues available for victims are still available. So when it comes to underreporting of LGBTI prejudice motivated crime, what we're looking here at, because there's underreporting, there often isn't enough for evidence for the police to investigate and then to go ahead and prosecute if at a later date a victim decides that they're going to report the crime. And this can shut down avenues, for example, to financial assistance through the Victims of Crime Assistance Tribunal for victims to get, for example, counselling and support or, you know, other forms of support that they need, for example, things like self-defense classes, or it could include things like public transport costs or, you know, security and surveillance system if they were attacked in their home. And they're shut down from accessing those civil support systems because of the underreporting and because they didn't feel confident in reporting in the first place.
Which is a shame, because there's even underlying all that is just the sense of acknowledgement that this is a valid experience, that this does occur. And to be acknowledged for that, to be acknowledged that you've gone through that, can have an immense impact on how you're able to deal with it moving into the future.
Yeah. And there's been a push for more rehabilitative focused outputs, really. In some ways, if it occurred in the children's court system, there would be more opportunities for a rehabilitative focus. So this is, for example, we have things
in comparison to punitive or
exactly, where what you're looking at, you've got a young person who has committed a prejudice motivated crime, and what you want, like, as part of the purpose of the criminal justice system, is prevention. It's supposed to be preventing these crimes from occurring. And if you say, well, here's this fine, pay this fine, and, you know, there are definitely statements that can be made by a magistrate or a judge in sentencing, but how effective a deterrent is that? But whereas there are programs that people can do which really inform them about the impact of their actions and make them understand the impact on victims, including things like group conferencing. And they're shown to be far more effective in actually preventing these kinds of crimes, alongside, you know, public education campaigns which really address the underlying factors in society which cause people to commit these crimes in the first place.
Joy 94.9.
This is Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9. We are in the studio with Lee Carney from the Human Rights Law Center, and we've been talking about prejudice-motivated crime. But more importantly, while we talk about this and what it looks like and what it feels like, what do we do when we actually experience it? So what advice would you give to someone who has been the target or subject of a crime or incident motivated by prejudice?
Absolutely. So if you are a victim of a crime or a victim of, you know, prejudice-motivated harassment, my advice would be, first thing that you want to do is you want to get all of your evidence prepared. So if there are witnesses who saw what happened while you're in that moment, if you can, if you've got friends with you who can, get their details, get their phone numbers, get their emails, that you can get in touch with them later, so that they can support your version of events, and that they can tell the police what happened as an independent witness. If you have any physical evidence, for example, if you've taken photos on your phone, or you think someone else has taken photos on their phone or a video on their phone, preserve that, send it to yourself, make sure that's safe. If there's any other physical evidence, for example, if there's any anything on your clothes, if you've been the victim of an assault, if there's a bottle thrown out of the car that could have DNA on it, that could have fingerprints on it, preserve that. You know, try not to touch it too much, but anything that you can get at that early stage that can assist the police, provide them with evidence to be able to investigate and charge later, that's really important. If you can't get any of that, at the very least, my advice would be, you know, write a detailed statement about what happened as soon as possible, while what happened is fresh in your mind. All the details are in there, times, how many people there were, where it happened. That, again, will assist the police later on. If you have been a victim of a crime or an incident, again, I would say, if you can, try and report it as soon as possible. If you feel comfortable contacting the police, then do that. If you don't just want to walk into a police station, then you can contact a GLLO, again, lesbian liaison officer. If you don't feel confident about walking into a police station, we know that there are many people in the LGBTI community who still feel this way, then, you know, go to a LGBTI community organization. I think we're going to talk about some of their referral points later, so definitely. I won't go into them, but if you stay tuned in, then we can talk about some of them and what they do and who you can go to for assistance. And I suppose, hopefully, what I hope that you can take out of this discussion from tonight is, even if you don't think it's serious enough to be a crime, it's still really important to report that incident to an LGBTI community group and to Victoria Police. And the reason for that is, think about perpetrators who have targeted multiple victims. So you it might be that someone has yelled something out the car at you, but they've also gone and thrown things out of the car at other people. And then what we know happens with people who commit crimes, and particularly violent crimes or crimes, you know, fueled by alcohol and prejudice is that there is generally an escalation of conduct. So someone who might generally starts off committing relatively minor crimes, they get away with it, and
they
then
think they can get worse and worse until they do something awful.
So it might be that even if you aren't able to identify the perpetrator in the particular case with you, you didn't catch the, you know, the registration plate of the car, or you have no way of really identifying the person beyond a physical description that you can give the police, that might still be of assistance. For example, it can point to trends of if there's a particular section of the street that you, where you were a victim of crime and someone 2 weeks ago also reports that, then the police have a sense, and community organisations as well have a sense, that there's this particular area that, that where there might be a heightened risk to LGBTIQ people. It also helps the LGBTI community advocates to share your stories and incidents to lobby for better protections for our community with government and with Victoria Police. Things like the community awareness campaigns we were speaking about, anti-bullying programs, improved data collections. So we've got a better sense of really what issue we're dealing with, but also greater training and education for everyone along every stage of this process to get better support for people who experience this. These types of crimes.
Well, it sounds like that's something we've heard from Victoria Police as well, that this is something they want to address. This is an issue that they are very keen to address, but that they just don't have the data to support diverting resources to it, because we don't necessarily think they meet that threshold for reporting. We don't think it's serious enough to waste their time, essentially. We don't think, and this goes to this idea of, I suppose it's called minority stress theory. So it's this idea that,
pray tell,
you know, it's very interesting, because we, you know, as we get into this discussion about marriage and the impact that it has on our health when we're denied certain basic civil rights or human rights, that it actually has an impact not only on our mental well-being, but our physical well-being, and that we suffer as a result of this discrimination and the stigma attached to being a sexual or gender minority. And so that's why we're at heightened risk for so many things, for, you know, substance use and abuse, drug and alcohol abuse, for mental health conditions. And so when somebody yells something out a car window or throws a bottle at you or even tries to bash you, you might not report it because you think, I'm not cared about. If I go to the police, they're just going to say, why are you whining to us? That you internalize all of this. So you still carry the burden of the experience, and you still feel the pain of that experience. But that does more damage than the inconvenience and discomfort of going to the police or going to somebody who can actually provide assistance. So that's why I say, whatever the threshold of this incident is, even if it's a minor one, for them to know about it is going to be immensely helpful in making it visible and thus giving us the opportunity to address it. I'm going off on this fun little policy tangent. But that's something we can talk about a bit more in depth in the next bit.
Joy 94.9.
Head to joy.org.au for fresh new podcasts, including Senator Pauline Hanson making her first appearance ever on Joy 94.9. Hear Pauline's stance on marriage equality and the plebiscite on Saturday Magazine. On the lighter side, Chris and Cam bring you the best of the Trash Mags news and gossip from Aussie TV and more on the CNC Drive Factory. While Dan and Andy get on 90s revival as they dust off the double denim and have a chin wag with Adele Lynch, lead singer of the iconic girl band Bewitched, on Podchops. And, of course, Joy celebrates diversity on the big screen and delves into the Emmys this week on Outtakes, Joy's source for all things queer film. Joy podcasts online at joy.org.au and via iTunes. This is Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9. We're here with Lee Carney once again. And we've been talking about prejudice-motivated crime and incidents and the impact that that has on our mental health and well-being. And we raise this as an issue because it's a bit unusual, we acknowledge, for Well, Well, Well. But we've seen an environment where dialogue and discourse around LGBTIQ identity has become a flashpoint. And it's the discussions that are taking place because of the possibility of a plebiscite that we've seen from the ACL because of the Safe Schools Coalition. And even this fight about getting birth certificate reform passed through the Victorian Parliament for trans people, and having seen this same similar reform, rather, fall back in South Australia. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So looking at all that, what's the impact that we're seeing on this? And more importantly, how do we protect ourselves from what might happen over the next few months?
Yeah.
Loaded question, I know.
Well, this is obviously a really big question. And, you know, I should put a disclaimer first that I'm a lawyer and that this is not really my area of expertise in terms of mental health impacts. But I know that in terms of the debate, as it's occurring, but also as we are concerned it is going to continue in a similar vein.
Yeah.
It has already had an impact on the LGBTIQ community and mental health in terms of demand for services, and the impact that, you know, is already being felt. And there's definitely a lot that we can do in terms of resilience. There are so many support organizations available to people, and there are so many kind of support networks and social networks that we can draw on when this is occurring. It's particularly important if, you know, you're listening in and you're feeling isolated and you feel like you don't have people that you can talk to about this. I think it's really important for us to talk about some of the supports that are available to you.
Because we were talking over the break about how often in these things we try to be resilient, we try to think that we're strong and that we can weather the tides, as it were, but when it comes down to it, when something actually, a substance hits the fan, we find ourselves really struggling, and that's probably the worst time to be trying to access these things. But some of the resources we discussed, at least here in Victoria, we do have VAC, the Victorian AIDS Council, that provides a counseling service. And that is obviously a great resource, and more information on that can be found at www.vac.org.au. I really should know that one.
Good plug.
But some of the other ones that people might not be aware of are, Gay and Lesbian Switchboard is quite well known, and that's simply a phone call away, and you can get excellent, excellent help for mental health. Again, referrals to further resources. Things like Headspace. Lee, you mentioned Headspace, but it was a particular type of
Headspace.
Q-Space. Okay. Yeah.
And so what is Q-Space? Yeah. So obviously Switchboard's a counselling line, VAC offers counselling services. So what is Q-Space?
So Q-Space, or Queer Space, as I think it's sometimes called, there's various Headspace offices around Australia. You have to be 25 or under to be able to access these services, but they're general support groups.
Ageist. Oh. Ageist.
But there's support groups if you're an LGBTIQ young person where you can go along. And the good thing about it is that it's really peer-based. So maybe you don't feel like there's something that you want to talk about with a psychologist directly, but maybe it's the kind of thing where you want to listen in and hear what other people your age are experiencing in a group setting and get a feel of the kinds of issues they're facing, and then you can chime in, or you've already got that support base there when something happens for you, even though at the moment there might not be anything that you really feel you need to talk about. It's kind of preparing and thinking about what you can do to prepare now, rather than waiting until you're at an absolute crisis point, and then at that point your ability to cope with stress and the mental health impacts will be severely limited, because you'll be in such an aroused state of anxiety and stress.
So
Drummond Street as well?
So there's Drummond Street Services. They're based out of Carlton, but they have a specialist LGBTIQ mental health unit, which can provide some excellent help. And again, it's better to talk to somebody rather than to try and hold it inside and think, I'm going to cope, I'm going to be capable, and ultimately end up hitting a breaking point. That's the last thing anybody of us wants. Going back to Switchboard, though, it's one of the top resources in the state of Victoria, and they can be accessed via telephone on 1-800-184-527. I do believe they also provide services to people in Tasmania, but their information can also be accessed on the web at switchboard.org.au. Another one, if you find yourself in the situation where you have been the victim of a crime or an incident, there is an excellent organization called the Anti-Violence Project. It's at antiviolenceproject.info, that's I-N-F-O, on the web. But they provide a third-party reporting mechanism, which means if you've been the victim of one of these crimes, you can go to them rather than the police. And these are peers. These are people from our community who have been trained and are supported to take your calls, to take your information, and then they can liaise with the police and help you find resources that you might need in order to support your own health and well-being and to cope with the trauma that has occurred as a result of these incidences. So again, that's the Anti-Violence Project at antiviolenceproject.info. But we need to also remember that, like we're talking about, we don't want to necessarily get to crisis point. So you're always welcome to go to your GP and ask for a mental health plan. It is your right as an Australian citizen or Medicare card holder. Be so freaking grateful and thankful that you have that resource, because it doesn't exist many places in the world, and it's pretty damn awesome. So remember, a mental health plan at your GP if you feel like that's something that's going to be helpful for you. Am I forgetting anything, Adam?
No, I think that kind of covers it. I guess, was there anything sort of, I guess, to add to the conversation that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, I had something I wanted to add. You're going to regret getting a lawyer on because we can talk forever. but I just wanted to comment on the fact that I'm really concerned about the potentially regressive impact of these kinds of debates on our community. We know from the Private Lives 2 survey, which I've already mentioned earlier in this hour, that when people experience this kind of prejudice-motivated abuse or incidents and harassments, a high number of them will occasionally or usually hide their sexuality or their gender identity in a range of situations for fear of the kind of abuse that they could experience. And so what this does for our community in some sense is it makes us feel less connected from each other. It actually makes us less resilient as a whole because we have parts of our community who are so afraid of what's going to happen that they don't feel like they can tell the supports around them about what their fears are and about what they need and what kind of support they need from those around them.
What if it's a third? Okay, so just something popped into my head, and obviously this is just the way I like to play it, so I just, this is how I roll. So what if it's a third-party conversation? So you're at work, for example, and you maybe not be out, and you're walking past the water cooler and somebody's talking about, well, why are we spending $170 million on a plebiscite for gay people to get married, the blah, 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 blah. And it's said in a very negative connotation, but it's not necessarily a prejudiced incident, but you're privy to it. I mean, are you able to either go down the legal pathway or speak to someone at work? I guess it depends on the work, but, I mean, accessing those services is kind of for anyone for any reason. But what about the legal context? Sorry to jump right back to the start.
No. So when we're talking about crimes, there has to be some kind of direct connection, usually something that makes you afraid for your safety. So a comment like that, you know, it's political discourse. It's unlikely to make you afraid for your safety. It's not a crime. That we don't have vilification protections. So even if it was something that was inciting hatred of a particular group in Victoria, that's, you know, unfortunately not covered under our current scheme, but it, you know, might fall under the, you know, abusive or threatening language if it was directed at a particular person. But for that kind of comment, it isn't a crime. There might be things that you could do in an employment situation in terms of, you know, policies and procedures in place to prevent against harassment and bullying. But it's not the kind of thing that is covered by this kind of hate crime legislation. I should also note that it's not just people within the LGBTI community who are going to be affected by this. It's also, you know, if you come to the rescue of your colleague because you feel like they're under attack directly or indirectly, it's for advocates or allies as well. If you're related to, you know, someone who is LGBTIQ identifying and you feel that fear for their safety or you're concerned about their mental health, and it can have a really serious impact on supporters and carers and friends. And, you know, as I said, like, it diminishes us as a whole. It diminishes our community as a whole.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. It's been incredibly enlightening. And I hope and think that our listener has probably taken something away and can hopefully be a bit more resilient as we get to face whatever heap of bullshit gets thrown our way over the next while.
If anything, at least it's the fact that these incidents are not just things that happen in passing and they should be reported.
Absolutely.
Whether it's to a community organisation or a support organisation, get them on record as much as practically possible. Get the evidence base there, even if it's from a research perspective, so that we can lobby the governments and local governments to actually change whether it's policing laws or legislation or whatever it might be, in the smallest way, everything in a cumulative total has a much bigger impact. And I think that's what you're saying, Lee. Small things, top level, you know, it all works from the top up to the bottom down, or the bottom down or the top up. But, yeah, well, thank you very much for coming in. But I guess that's the end of our show. We've kind of really flown through.
There's too much to talk about and more to go, but so it goes.
Absolutely. Well, I guess the one thing that we will plug is that we've got Northside Bazaar coming up very soon, which is a fundraiser for Joy FM and also for VAC's David Williams Fund.
Yes.
And I guess what we are hoping to achieve is that there'd be people out there, whether it be groups, individuals, organisations who want to donate something that can be auctioned off at the Laird on the 15th 15th of October.
It is, yes.
Yeah, 15th, great.
Sunday the 15th of October, 1 to 7 p.m., I think.
Something like that. But all the proceeds go straight to Joy and David Williams Fund. So they're both really good causes. So if you've got something sitting around that you go, oh, you know what, I don't know about that. Or if you're an organization, you're like, you know what, I can give a free trip, or I can give a massage, or I can do something like that. Why not? Just go to northsidebazaar.com.au and actually find the links there in about how to donate something, because it's a fantastic cause. It's a great day. So yeah, I guess I just wanted to plug that.
Yeah, hey, even if you can't donate something, show up. It's one of the best afternoons you will have all year.
I know, I promised I'd go this year because I've never been before. Yes, bad gay, bad gay. I get
how
it.
Very dare you.
I get it. This is Well 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 on Joy 94.9. It's been great chatting with you guys, and we will be back next week.
Well, well, well on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.